Welcome to Florida.
That is the voice of New York Times best-selling author and award-winning environmental reporter Craig Pittman. My name is Chad Scott, and this is Welcome to Florida. Craig had the environmental reporter hat on recently, an article in the Florida Phoenix, floridaphoenix.com. Just, you know, a classic, irrefutable example of climate change.
Yeah, I was writing about sea turtles. One of the coolest things I ever covered was I actually got to see a loggerhead sea turtle drag itself up the beach on a on a dark night, dig a hole, lay its eggs, and then drag itself back down and into the Gulf of Mexico and swim away. And it was just a marvelous event to witness. And so I kind of pay attention to the stats on sea turtles as a result. And I had the sort of good news, bad news that, you know, on the one hand, you know, apparently the sea turtles that were on the Southwest Florida coast, they had a record year of hatching their nestling, their hatchlings prior to the hurricane hitting. On the other hand, they're almost all going to turn out to be female because the temperature of the sand determines the gender of the hatchlings. And it's been so hot that almost no males are being born. And I talked to several scientists about this, that they said, you know, it's a phenomenon, and there's, you know, it's just something that we've been measuring, and you can't say it's not happening. The sand is getting hotter and hotter and hotter. And right now it's producing all female sea turtles, which of course is going to cause a huge gender imbalance in the population. But the other problem is if it gets much hotter, it'll start not producing hatchlings. It would be too hot for them to develop in the eggs.
Bake them out.
And So, well, you know,
what a fascinating piece of biology, one. And when you say nearly, I mean, you're talking 99% of eggs. And again, this is a natural population. 99% one way or the other is not sustainable.
Yeah.
You know, and through the, you know, course of history, there have been warm seasons and cool spells and warm spells, and it's all kind of balanced out, you know, to create a near 50-50 balance for turtles. 99-1 is not balanced. And this, to me, is one of those, similar to the pictures of Glacier National Park or in Alaska, where here's what the glacier looked like in 1903, and it's this giant white wall straight up, you know, into the foreground of the camera. Here's what it looked like in 2004, and you can't even see it anymore. It's just a rocky dirt patch. This, like that, is irrefutable evidence of climate change. And the DeSantis plan of seawalls and pumps and dikes and drains will do nothing to help this.
No, basically he's just protecting waterfront property owners, and that's it. And he's not doing anything. And he makes it very clear, I'm not going to do anything to wean Florida off of fossil fuels. And he's happy with that.
Which does nothing to, you know, help the animals like the turtles who suffer. But you've brought up this many times before, and I do just enough work outside that I can sympathize. I am fortunate that I don't have to do that for a living, but all these folks, whether they are picking lettuce or farmers or roofers or all those folks laying asphalt across this state, most of which doesn't need to be put down.
The kids taking your order at Chick-fil-A at the Gainesville Chick-fil-A. They're outside. You know?
All those folks who have to work outside when it's getting warmer and warmer and warmer and warmer. What about them, Governor?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
Don't matter. No, clearly they don't. That's a rhetorical question, because if any of that mattered, there would be some effort made by this state to not only build resiliency against the inevitable and climate change and sea level rise, but attempt to halt it. And again, you're not going to stop it. You're not going to turn back. But there's a great deal that we know that could be done today to halt it.
Right.
The governor and the leadership of the state could not be less interested in doing so. And in fact, is full speed to the floor in the other direction supporting.
I was just going to say, here's one piece of good news that I stumbled across. I haven't written about it yet, that I think Florida now is second in the nation for electric vehicles. And thanks to federal funding, we're getting more charging stations around the state. So that'll help.
FloridaPhoenix.com. Read about sea turtles and the trouble they're having with the population numbers and the gender balance there. All right. That takes us to this week's guest. And if you listen around lunchtime, you will enjoy this surely. Our guest is Carlos Frias. He is the longtime Miami Herald food critic. He just left that job to become a host at radio station WLRN in South Florida. He hosts the Sundial program, which runs Monday through Thursday, noon to 1 o'clock. They cover South Florida all the way from the Keys to Palm Beach. So if you're looking for a daily fix of Florida and you are through your Welcome to Florida episodes, go ahead and check out WLRN Sundial and Carlos Frias. And what are we talking to him today about specifically, Craig?
We're talking about croquetas, which are sort of this, to me, it's sort of like if you saw the movie Ratatouille, where the food critic takes a bite and it takes him back to childhood. To me, that's what croquetas are, is they're this sort of food that brings all of Miami together, I think. And he has said that Miami is the croqueta capital of the world. So we'll explore that.
All right. Here we go with Carlos.
Carlos, thank you so much for joining us today. Let me ask you a really stupid question first, which is, what is the correct way to pronounce croquetas?
You can do it like you're from the South and call it a croqueta. That's fine. That's acceptable. I'm not going to get mad at that. If you're, si eres español, le dices croqueta, croqueta. But if you're a Cuban, you call it una croqueta, which is a little bit somewhere in between the real tight Spaniard way and the Southern way. And the Miami way, somewhere between Miami and Miami.
Gotcha. Well, now that we know what to call it, what is it?
So a croqueta is this, I would almost call it like a ham fritter. Okay. So it's like a flour and cheese and ham fritter. You kind of make like a bechamel base, which is kind of like a cream base with very chopped ham, like the consistency and flavor of kind of a deviled ham. Mm. You cool that overnight, then scoop it out, roll it in some breadcrumbs, and deep fry it. So you basically have this this perfect little calorie bomb that is fried. It's delicious. It's warm, though they're delicious cold too. I guess you can say I'm a croqueta slut. I'll take them anyway.
Is that like a common thing for everybody? Is that, you know, like a something that everybody in Miami would eat necessarily?
Yeah, I think a croqueta is this easy finger food in South Florida. It's you know, I joke that Miami is the croqueta capital of the world. Obviously, Miami did not invent these, but because they were such a big deal in Cuba, and Cubans imported so much of their culture when they found a new home for their culture in South Florida, it has become this kind of ubiquitous party food.
Where was it invented? Where did it come from?
So as near as anyone can tell, both the French and the Spaniards claim it, and it was in that northern part of France, in that territory that's almost like Basque territory. So I mean, the Basque have a lot of food that's very similar, kind of like Basque cheesecake. Have you ever seen it? It looks like regular slice of cheesecake, but it's ultra creamy. Like it's almost like. Like when you warm up cheese and melt it, it's like that. Hmm. So the croqueta feels in that same vein. You know, the Spanish / French version is very creamy inside. It's a perfect little golf ball sized ball that when you crack it open, it almost oozes. The ones that you see in you know, South Florida are a little different. They're a little bit doughier. They have more flour to ham ratio. And I think that just comes down to, honestly, it's poor people food, right? Like the most, you'll see poor people food regularly be like a starch encasing a little bit of protein, and it's a way to make food go further. Mm-hmm. If I can actually tell a pretty good story, I thought it was Jose Andres, who is he's the well known world renowned chef, but also humanitarian. He tells this great story about how when he was young and his family was poor, both his parents were. They were in the medical field. I want to say his mom was a nurse. I think they were both nurses. And, you know, money was tight in Spain in that time. I mean, certainly Spain had been through horrendous economic times, especially in the early 80s, late 70s. And his mom would use croquetas as a way of making that that little bit of ham, that jamón left over, chopped up and put into the bechamel sauce to make it last. So she'd make this big tray, almost like a deep casserole of this bechamel cream sauce, put it in the fridge, and that's where it gets nice and cold and it congeals. And he and his brother would sneak out in the middle of the night and reach into the casserole and just dig their fingers into this, like if it was a, like if it was a pot of peanut butter, you know, and kind of try to smooth it over afterwards, like, oh, nothing happened here.
Yeah.
But it's so it's very much ingrained in Latin culture, derived from Spain or France. And and it's very much the everyman's food, which is really kind of why I endorse it. And I love it.
Do people get it at restaurants or do they make it at home or is there a mix of both?
I don't think it's a fine dining food, although I have seen fine dining versions of croquetas. I think that, and I've had some really good ones. I've had some, you know, with that protein inside is actually a short rib and they add a little bit of Gruyere to add a little bit of succulence to it. And those are fine. But the truth is it's such a simple food. It's one of those things that you buy for a dollar and a quarter at really like little window stands and even gas station setups they have, because it's so much more. It's like a grab and go type of food, you know. So I think fancier versions are a little bit of trite when you know it's hard to overcome the original.
Yeah, is that ham seasoned with anything? The minced ham in inside.
Yeah, I mean, parsley is a big thing you'll see in a lot of them, you know, certainly, you know, salt and pepper. And there's usually minced onions and sometimes minced garlic in there. So there's a lot of like that flavor bomb that you get in some Latin cuisine. You know, it's like if it doesn't have garlic in it, it just it's disqualified as an edible product.
Are there other types of meats besides ham that are used?
Oh yeah, like nowadays, I think you'll find very regularly chicken. Spinach is very common, believe it or not. I know it sounds like some kind of a newish invention, but it's been around for a while. And codfish, you know, they're very similar to frituras de bacalao. So like bacalao, you know, the Italians have bacalao, you know, and it's real codfish. You know, it's very flexible. And you'll find it in croquetas too in there, and they're great too.
You have covered food for a long time, and you mentioned how croquetas are initially food of poor people, how to stretch ingredients to go further. It seems like whether that's food trucks, street food, barbecue, you know, the most exciting things happening in food and increasingly in restaurants are these foods of poor people or rural people. When did that trend begin, or at least in South Florida, when you started noticing, wow, all of a sudden this poor folks food is going uptown?
Well, I feel like it's a little bit of a pendulum swing, right? Like I think South Florida, Miami in particular, you know, was not a big town. You know, it hasn't been a very big city, you know, for most of its existence. So like very accessible food. And like when you had a lot of the immigrants, like obviously the Cuban immigrants of the late 60s and early 70s, you're talking about 500,000 Cubans in about a 10-year period, really overnight make it that much bigger of a city. So, but you still, there are a lot of immigrant workers and what have you. And it's a lot of work, people's food, you know? So like you have mainly this influx of a very accessible food. And then we all start getting obsessed with like the cooking TV shows, right? Like the Top Chefs and everything else. And there's a kind of an interest in like, wait, all this food that we've been eating, how can we make this fancier? Or how can we apply more advanced techniques, you know, molecular gastronomy to food, adding, you know, things that are sous vide, different cooking methods, you know, different French methods fused with very common food. And then now you have a little bit of the pendulum swing going the other way. Like for people who like love the TV shows, but some of the stuff feels inaccessible. There's a return to the more basic, the more accessible foods, but maybe done with a little bit of what we've learned in these last 20 years of trying to apply different techniques to some of the food we already know. So I feel like there's a little bit of a of an appreciation of some of the original food. And I think we're seeing that more, even like look beyond Latin food, but like fried chicken. Fried chicken became like, you saw it served in New York City with alongside caviar. So you could dip the fried drumstick in caviar. This was one of, I think it was at a Momofuku restaurant, David Chang restaurant. And now it's like the spicy chicken sandwich at Popeyes. Like that was the hot thing too, you know? So I think there is an appreciation for making accessible food done really well, you know? Because I don't know about you guys, but did you feel like when you look back at the history of America, that's a long subject, but when you look back, don't you feel like there was all this mechanization of food, like making food easier to warm up and eat, you know, TV dinners and Twinkies and all of this kind of like bastardization of, you know, natural, ingredients. Simple food, right? Using all these advanced processes to make it easier for...
Well, and I think that extends to American society, like better living through science, right? I mean, every single thing that was viewed as progress in this country was to make it cheaper, easier, more industrial, more mechanical, more efficient, to take the craft out of it. And I think you could argue we're going through something of a, you know, a neo arts and crafts movement, whether that's farm to table with food, whether it's slow fashion as a revolt against fast fashion and all of the problems there, a return to artists, you know, how many people, you know, and I think the pandemic highlighted this, you know, essentially the modern day Victory Garden, right? Trying to bring these ingredients back to their home and some sense of ownership of the process of the things you bring into your home and into your body, especially, I mean, the food, the standard American diet is horrific for the way it treats people, the way it treats employees, the way it treats animals. You know, and I think it's exciting that we're starting to consider how does all this stuff get to us? And what are the costs beyond dollars and cents? What are the costs to the workers, the animal, you know, the whole thing of, and I'm not going to get out of a rant here on Big Ag, but I mean, yeah, I totally agree with you.
No, it's the whole idea of we've forgotten where our food comes from, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm not obviously not the first person saying this. It's been said for the past couple decades. You know, people look at chicken breasts and it's this totally antiseptic looking, perfect little you know, peach orb that is just in the Publix food aisle, you know, and like one generation ago, you know, my dad, who was a farmer in Cuba, like to get to that perfect cutlet takes a lot of work. And, you know, we lived in Miramar, which is kind of suburban, a suburban area. I guess you'd call it a suburb of Fort Lauderdale, maybe of Miami, kind of right in the middle. And we had chickens in the backyard. We had a little coop. and, you know, when the chickens got too ordinary, my dad made fricasse de pollo, you know, or arroz con pollo. And like we saw that, I mean, I saw that process, like this is where the food comes from. And it does make you think a lot more critically about how important it is to treat those ingredients and the process from which it gets to animal into your belly, you know?
Absolutely. You know, people are always looking for ways they can help save the planet. I think one of the, I mean, for some people, it'll be easier than others based on access, but shop at a farmer's market instead of a grocery store. The stuff you get from a grocery store, you know, it comes from Big Ag, which is huge on chemical inputs. It is almost surely picked or grown at an abusive rate to the employees. It has been shipped on a truck, belching out carbon emissions hundreds, if not thousands of miles. You start adding up the cost of all of that to the planet. And now it's incredibly efficient and damn, it's cheap and it's easy. But boy, if you can go to that farmer's market in your town on Saturday or Sunday and buy from a person who has a farm with some cattle and, like you said, some chickens, and they're making eggs and cheese 10, 20, 30, 40 miles away, you're supporting a person instead of a corporation for one thing, but it's also going to be better food, much more ethically produced.
I mean, anybody that listens to this podcast will get what it's like to eat a mango out of your backyard. You know, it's like we take for granted how amazing and fresh and piney and mm-hmm. sweet they are. And then if you live in a state where mangoes aren't, you know, they don't grow, it's outside of a tropical or subtropical area, and you get them brought in, that mango is like a shadow of what it could be, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that's a perfect example is try to find stuff that grows where you live. Mm-hmm. And usually it'll be the best versions of it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think we have to mix in, right? Like, I will say that like variety is the thing that makes mm-hmm. Our food and our palates more interesting, and you know that complexity of flavor. So you have to bring some things in that don't grow locally. I mean, yeah. Like,
and that's I don't, you know, no one's saying to move off the grid and start, you know, raising your own sheep and slaughtering them, and that, I mean, that's not practical. But between there and a TV dinner, there's a lot of room for improvement. And you're touching on a lot of issues that are big to me, but food is medicine. And if the food you put into your body is trash, you will feel like trash. I assure you. Try eating, and again, eating healthy and farmers markets and going to Whole Foods, that is not cheap. I'm not going to pretend that it is. And that industrial scale of our American agricultural system has really brought the prices of things down, but it has done so at a real cost to health and family farmers and the environment and animals and so on and so forth.
You know what I'll say though is some things like, I'm sorry, I don't mean to
cut. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
I'll say some things like the you know, pandemic, everybody was baking bread, right? Everybody was making sourdough bread at home. And if you add up the cost of doing that, it is infinitesimally small. Especially when you compare it to like going to the local artisanal baker, mm-hmm. you know, where like a loaf of bread could cost between $6 and $8 maybe. Right.
Yeah.
And like with a $3 bag of flour, you know, water and some yeast that you just like cultivated home, like that literally just leaving it open to open ferment, like we made, and a loaf of bread will last a week. And it really is like the first time that you make bread, it's fascinating. It becomes a different part of your brain lights up. Like, one, this is really easy to make. This is cheap to make. This is interesting. Mm-hmm. And it's delicious. And I remember like just sending a text to like one of our local artists here, Zach the Baker, who's a James Beard Award finalist as one of the best bakers in the country. But I got to know him a little bit and I was like, hey man, I made bread at home. And I sent him a picture and I was like, this is great. And he's like, there's something magical about making bread, about baking bread. And he's totally right.
You mentioned about your dad. Was that who first made a croqueta for you?
No, croquetas we didn't make at home because, believe it or not, croquetas are labor intensive. They are like, you, number one, you have to wait overnight. Already it's like, that, you know, I'm out, you know, especially when you want them now and they cost a dollar and a quarter at Versailles, you know, it makes it. Yeah, because you know you have to make the bechamel sauce, then you have to let it set and thicken, and then you have to like bring it out of the fridge when they're cool, right? And you have to quickly scoop them, bread them, and drop them right in perfectly hot oil. And those are all like the frying is hard at home, the moving that quick. Those are like, you know, those are moves of crafts, you know, of craft people. So no, I didn't have my croquetas at home. I had them at the window where they live.
Now those windows have a special name, right? The Cuban restaurants, the walk up windows where you can get to your Cubano sandwich or your croquette. What are those called again?
We call them ventanitas.
Ventanitas, nothing, that's right.
Nothing more than little window. That's all that means, ventanita. And that was, you know, as we talked a little bit about earlier, that was another importing of culture, right? Because in Cuba there was no air conditioning. By the way, if you zoom out on the planet, very few places on the planet have central AC like we all do in our South Florida homes. Mm-hmm. It's still the case. So in Cuba, you'd had these little outdoor, almost like hot dog carts where people sold coffee. Like, people would come from their jobs or whatever breaks in the day, and they were constantly making espresso coffee. That or these little kiosks with no front windows, and they would just they'd sell coffee at like 3 cents a cup. My dad had one of these in Cuba. When they all came here to the U.S., like all this mass influx of Cubans, something interesting happened in that right around the early 60s, you have this confluence of all these Cubans who would love to go to the store and have their coffee. in this really hot, steamy South Florida climate, which had just started to appreciate and have access to air conditioning. So a lot of these restaurants were closing in. You know, they had been kind of open front. There were a lot of open front buildings. You know, they just had like a gate come down or what have you, but they were not air conditioned, you know? And so they were closing in and getting air conditioning. But like, how do you keep the culture, that gathering place coffee culture, and appreciate the benefits of this cool AC? And the solution was quite simply a little window with a counter that you could open up. And you get, number one, not just access to the coffee, but this little blast of that cool air on the inside, right?
Yeah.
And so everybody, you know, when it's August and it's 6,000 degrees and everybody's huddled around the window drinking coffee and getting that little blast of the cool air, like that's a nice merging of two cultures, I think.
Absolutely.
Well, now, so how did the croquetas become a standard thing to order at the Ventanita?
Well, that's a tough one. I think it's just one of those finger foods that you'd find regularly that was part of coffee, because so much of like the culture down here is kind of stopping in at La Ventanita to get a little bite between, you know, you're going to a meeting and it's like 11 o'clock and it's, you know, maybe it's 11:30 and you're getting something before lunch, maybe, or it's like 2 p.m. and you're kind of dragging, you're getting some coffee and you're not going to eat till like, you know, especially Latins notoriously eat late. So it's like you go in, you get your coffee, and you have these little finger foods, you know, this, like I said, this protein bar, you know, this deep fried protein bar, or you've had like these pastelitos, which, you know, in Tampa, they obviously have them too. Although they call them something slightly different. Maybe they call them pasteles, or I've seen them called turnovers, which, you know, I bristle at, but that's okay. And it's like, and you know, that's puff pastry with like some really high sugar, like a guava marmalade inside. And so you get, again, a little bit of that carb, a little bit of protein, you know, your shot of caffeine. And it's like, that's enough to get you through for the next 4 or 5 hours. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. What does croquetas translate to in English as near as you can make it?
Protein bar.
Yeah. No, all right.
It's just its own word. Like, yeah. That's why we think it's, you know, the French call it a croquette. There's a Q and there's double T's in there. Of course, there's extra letters that you don't use, as the French love to do.
But they charge extra for that.
They do. They do. Served through the side of haughtiness.
Yeah. Well, where point out some places in Miami to find a good croqueta for our audience.
Well, like I said, the croquetas live at the Ventanita. That's their that's where they exist.
That's their habitat. Natural
environment. Yeah. Exactly. That's their habitat. So really, one of the most iconic ones in South Florida is the Ventanita at Versailles. Versailles is probably the most famous Cuban restaurant in the world, I think. Yeah, even if you include Cuba. Floridita is pretty close too, in Havana. But like, it's just a great atmosphere. You walk up and they have a double Ventanita because, you know, that's how they roll. And they're constantly turning over coffee and quick bites. And the window waitresses are a story in themselves. You know, they're very gregarious and they will call you mi amor y mi querido. And it's like that. It's like a merging of Latin and Southern hospitality, I think, is really what's so great about it. And that it's a whole scene. So you'll still have some of the old timers talking politics, and you'll have some tourists. So you're not going to feel like you're, you know, if you're from out of town, you're not going to feel like you're out of place. And it's a really iconic spot. I mean, I like this one. It's kind of out of the way. I have to be in the neighborhood to go get it, because nobody drives half an hour to a Ventanita because there's too many of them. But there's an iconic place called Islas Canarias, the Canary Islands, which a lot of Cubans and Cuban families are from, like their origins. And this spot started in Little Havana, but is now in West Kendall. We call it the Kingdom of Kendall, my buddy Amy Reyes and I, and it's a place where it serves some of maybe the best version of Cuban food in Miami, in the wow. Miami area. Yeah, and they have a great lively Ventanita with like two sides to it, you know, kind of like forms a little corner, so they have two sides to serve out of, and it's very bustling and it's really cool. It's in the middle of suburbia, but it fits perfectly there.
You mentioning Isla Canarias reminded me, there was a New York Times story back in February about croquetas and suggesting there were lots of new flavors now. What was your reaction when you saw that?
You can predict where I stand on this.
Well, tell us for the folks who don't know you.
Yeah, no. I'm a traditionalist when it comes to them. I mean, I'm always curious to see what people do with them. You know, like I said, there's a place down here called Chugs that puts short rib in them. People love them. They're fine. I guess I can just order short rib though. And mm-hmm. that's where I want that. I've had one that has pastrami in it at a place called Kush, which it's, I mean, you'd have to be using a lot of Kush to then be like, dude, what else could I put in this croquetta, bro? Pastrami.
We'll you sure do they crazy didn't just accidentally it. Drop it in there?
Bro, did you put pastrami in this croquetta? Like, so good, dude. So it's fine. People, you know, I'm not a book thumper when it comes to China changing food and whatever. I just like, I prefer simple flavors, you know, delivered, like executed really well. So.
Yeah,
that's where I come down on those.
Yeah, we talk a lot about Miami, obviously, on this podcast, and Miami's growth and ascension into this just amazing contemporary global city with a Latin flavor. We talk a lot about the Miami Book Fair, which is the best book fair in the United States. Art Basel, Bert. Miami Beach is the largest, best contemporary art fair in North America, at the very least, if not the world. Is Miami's food scene up to that cultural level? And you know, I mean, you've again covered it for a long time. When you go to New York and, you know, come back to Miami, travel around, is Miami's culinary scene at that globally important level now?
I do think so. I do think so. And I think it has a lot to do with diversity. I think one of the things that makes New York, a place like New York, their food scene great is not just like, hey, the best of the best are here, but no, they have variety. They have diversity in their food. You know, you can get everything from, you know, a good cheeseburger to Ghanaian food. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You can find a little bit of everything. And I think Miami is like that too, in a way. Like it's this meeting place of Latin America and the US and Europe, because so much of Europe comes to vacation and spend their dollars here. Thank you, Europe. and because they, you know, that kind of opens up your access, you know, people that have come here and that, you know, we know stories of folks who come from, you know, France and little towns in Italy and never leave, you know, either because they have, either they love it here or they're running from something more than likely. Or they have an influx of cash that they need to launder. Also very common.
Yes.
Like, what are all these Italian restaurants? Yeah, I'll tell you what all those Italian restaurants are. I have some theories. But you get enough of those things and you have people that go and say, oh, this is an Italian. I just stayed here. And, you know, my grandmother's recipe is better than this. And, you know, we cook it at home and everybody says how they love it. And they open a restaurant. And and then you have, you know, Peruvian food. We've had such an influx of Peruvian food since really Peru has had, like, you know, a lot of other Latin American countries have their waves where they go through economic crises. We've had a big contingent of Peruvian immigrants who've brought with them their incredible cuisine. So I think all of those things add to make Miami an interesting place food wise. I mean, the fact that there's a Michelin guide here is not, I try to tell people the Michelin guide exists to sell Michelin guides. So like keep that in your frame of reference, but then also acknowledge that they only would sell guides here if they thought they could sell enough of them, you know, if enough people would pay attention to them. And there's no Michelin guide in Des Moines, Iowa, you know,
and the food there's great. Yeah. I just happened to be researching this for a story, but the first Michelin guide to Florida, which focuses on Miami, Orlando and Tampa, came out in the summer of 2022. So this is not, you know, something that Michelin has said, yeah, Florida cuisine has always been world-class. And that's what the Michelin guide is. I mean, it's these starred and exceptional restaurants all over the world. You know, it's your Paris, your London, your Vienna, your that kind of thing. But in the United States, they only have a handful of guides, New York, Chicago and Illinois, California, and now Florida. Again, there's not a Michelin guide to Texas or Georgia or North Carolina. And I think it's you know, it's a foodie kind of thing that probably doesn't resonate to Main Street USA, but it is a major milestone in terms of international recognition of Florida cuisine. And that all starts in Miami. Miami certainly leads the way there. Florida, you know, Tampa and Orlando are the sidecar, but Miami is leading the way.
Yeah, I think that that's true. Like once you have a place where people can nerd out about a thing, like they mm-hmm. can go to the very extreme and be like, oh, this is the very finest of the dining.
Yeah.
Like when you have something for those folks, that means that you have plenty for everybody else too to really yeah. experience. I mean, like on an average week, like I said, I've been homesick with stupid COVID this week, and we've ordered Uber Eats from, we've had Lomo Saltado, which is a Peruvian dish. I've had amazing Neapolitan pizza delivered to my house. You know, I had a great cheeseburger delivered from a local place.
Yeah.
So not to mention during Thanksgiving, like I made beer can chicken. So like, I think we're in an kind of environment where you have such a wide range of food to choose from. And that's what makes Miami really an interesting place to eat.
Yeah.
Let me ask a dangerous question. I don't want to spark a war.
Oh boy, this is Cuban sandwich related, isn't it?
Well, here's my question. Cuban sandwiches divide people. Clearly there's a strong division over that. Do croquetas, do they do the opposite? Do they bring people together?
Oh, wow. I love that question. I did not see that coming. I'm going to say yes, because I've not had a person who had a croqueta and said, I hate that. Maybe they'll have something else and say, I like that more. But a croqueta is very, you know, is a very accessible food, especially when it's hot out of the fryer. So I'm going to say yes. I'm going to say that ain't nobody not like a croqueta.
Maybe that's the secret to bringing our society together. Serve everybody some right. croquetas.
Nobody doesn't love croquetas.
Yeah. Carlos Frias has been our guest, host at WLRN Radio down there in South Florida. You can find him on Twitter at Carlos_Frias, Frias. Thank you so much for joining us and whetting our appetite today.
Yeah, big time. I have to clean up the drool now.
It's my pleasure, guys. Anytime.
There's just no denying it. You were just down there for the book fair. I recently wrote about Art Basel, Miami Beach. I mean, Miami is on that scene with Tokyo and London and Paris and New York. It is remarkable how that's, well, for sure, it's all occurred in both of our lifetimes. You know?
Yeah. But, you know, you still run into little quirks here and there. While I was there, we were trying to get for dinner one night, we were trying to get pizza mm-hmm. for the kids to eat. And my wife kept like rephrasing the order and the guy was like not understanding her. And finally he explained, oh, well, we have pizza with vegetables on it and we have pizza with meat on it. We don't have any pizzas that have both of those on.
Really?
Yeah. It's like, why not? I've never heard of that. That was the way it was. So, yeah. you had to kind of work around it.
Do you like going to Miami? I mean, Miami, you know, it is super developed. It is, you know, busy and bustling and noisy and the traffic. And now every time it rains hard, it floods. But, you know, again, you were there recently. I love it for what it is. I don't think I could live there. I want some sense of seasons, which is why I live in North Florida. But, you know, I wave the Miami banner for what it is as hard as I can. I think it's just this spectacular global melting pot city.
Yeah. And I enjoy visiting. I could not possibly live there. It's not my scene, but I'll tell you a funny story. While I was there, I was trying to do some legwork for my next book. And so I interviewed someone who lives in he mentioned about Kendall. I interviewed someone who lived in Kendall. So it took me about 30 minutes to get out there from downtown Miami to this suburban area. And, you know, the whole way I'm on these very tightly packed roads, finally get out there, do the interview. The next night I have an interview with someone who's in Homestead.
Yeah.
45 minutes away. Yeah. Way south. And she lives near Everglades National Park. Mm-hmm. So it's way out in the middle of nowhere. And I get there and we're talking and she says, yeah, we're moving. I said, why are you moving? She said, it's getting too crowded out here. But what she meant was not that the development was closing in on where they lived. It's that if they wanted to go anywhere else, it would take too long because the amount of traffic involved. She said, if I want to go talk to my county commissioners to complain about something they've done, it's going to take me all day to get up there and to get back.
Yeah. Well, and from Homestead, you know, the development, you know, runs 100 miles north to Palm Beach, you know, basically uninterrupted. It's just, you know, what has happened to South Florida. This is a topic we've done a lot of and will continue on the podcast, but it is remarkable. Welcome to Florida.
Welcome to Florida.